You're listening to Slow Theology, Simple Faith for Chaotic Times, with AJ Swoboda and Nijay Gupta.
Nijay and AJ back. Today we have a conversation that we want to have around the topic of children, and specifically how children actually help us know God and walk with Jesus. In a way, how children actually help our theology become really good. So there's right at the current moment, I'm writing a book on the topic of how Christians can and should be able to learn from anybody and everybody. So I've got a chapter on how to learn from strangers, how to learn from enemies, how to learn from the dead, how to learn from experts, just a bunch of groups of people that Christians often are not very good at learning from. Mm. And in one of the chapters, I do a bunch of work on how and why it's important that we learn from children. What do children have to teach us? What do we have to learn from those that are younger than ourselves, the younger among us? And in the midst of the research for this book, I was able to tap into a vignette of research that was just brand new to me, of a movement called the Child Theology Movement. And it's a whole movement that attempts to bring children into theological dialogue. And the whole premise of this movement, the Child Theology Movement, is that story in Matthew's gospel where Jesus, the children come to Jesus, and they were in his midst. But then, of course, the disciples rebuke the children and try to get them away. But that phrase, in their midst, that Jesus, the children were in their midst. And the basic premise of the Child Theology Movement is that when kids are in the room, it helps hold our theology to a sort of clarity and wonder and generosity and love that we don't often find in academic circles, often around adults.
Yeah.
And I, by the way, this does not mean that children are always right. Children are often very wrong.
Disclaimer.
Yeah. FYI. This is not some argument that kids are always right, but it's a really interesting premise. Does having children in the room, I'm playing this out in my mind, right? It's very often that we have, you know, theological disputes on the interwebs. Even as we're talking today, there's one raging today about some new thing, about some, this theologian said this and somebody else is mad at him for it and trying to cancel him and all this sort of stuff. But it does awake a kind of interesting conversation. Like, if kids are in the room, are we going to act differently than if they're not? Right. Are we going to think differently than if they're not in the room? Do we reflect about God with a different affect if our children are in the room? Because we all know we talk very differently to our spouses or to our friends when our kids are in the room than when they're not.
Mm-hmm.
We talk differently. It's not necessarily that we say different things. Maybe we do, but the quality of our talk is different because we know the way we talk actually forms our kids.
Yeah.
So I guess to open the conversation today, Nijay, how in your mind do children serve us well in how we think about God? How do kids actually shape our theology?
It's a great question, and I should have, I don't know if I'll have huge, profound answers, but I should, because my wife has a background in youth ministry, and so I've learned a lot from her. But I want to start with something I've been thinking about a lot lately. I just finished watching a TV series from National Geographic called A Small Light, which is about the Anne Frank family, specifically about a woman named Miep Geese, who was instrumental in hiding the Frank family and protecting them and feeding them and keeping them safe for as long as she could. And you got a glimpse. I've watched and read stuff about Anne Frank, but this went pretty in depth. And it was multi-episode, quite long episodes. And one thing that struck me was after the Frank family was arrested and taken away, Miep Geese, this woman, and her husband Jan, they secretly went in and tried to collect valuables in the event that they could get the Franks freed. And so they're looking for jewelry, or they're looking for heirlooms, and they find Anne's diary. And Meep's initial goal was to hold on to the diary until she could give it back to Anne, right? And once it became clear that that was not going to happen, then she gave it to the only survivor of that family, which was Otto Frank, the father. And the what really struck me was how precious that journal of a 13-year-old, I think she was 13, how precious that journal is for understanding the heart and soul of what was going on for victims at that time. We have all kinds of official accounts. We have all kinds of politicians and survivors that have spoken. That's all valuable. But to hear from a 13-year-old,
yeah,
and to hear her, and what, and hers was a voice of authenticity, I think.
Yeah.
And so one thing we get from children, not always, obviously there are exceptions, but especially young children, is authenticity. I mean, to read her journal, think how precious Anne Frank's journal is. 100 years-ish after the events, right? When in its own time, you know, it's just the ramblings of a young girl. And think how much, how many millions of dollars that journal is worth.
Yeah.
Right? And her age being a factor in that, because you're getting a glimpse of love and depression and hope. She expresses a lot of hope. They dream about going back to school when the parents are cynical. So one thing I think that we learn from children is they often wear their thoughts and their hearts on their sleeve in a way that challenges us stuffy adults, where we kind of operate with what is and we don't often deal enough with what can be.
Oh, gosh. I get really – tell me, do you feel this sometimes? I actually get really cynical when I talk to adults, because I know more often than not, adults are just peddling what they heard on the news that morning, or what their favorite
posturing
podcaster.
Yeah.
Right. We're posturing. Like we're all hiding this ideology behind our conversation. And I just almost lose trust with adults that I'm not being sold something, that I'm not trying to be manipulated, that I'm not trying to be swayed in one particular direction. It's almost like with adults, you just know that you're not getting the true thing necessarily, because we're just, I don't know, we're more swayed by the battle at play. Whereas with kids, like a child is not peddling what they heard on CNN or Fox this week.
Yeah.
They ask.
I hope.
Yeah. I mean, they ask and say the most exposing stuff.
Yeah.
I almost want to say this. They haven't given in to the peer pressure of being politically correct.
Yeah.
Like they just say what's on their mind and their heart, not what they heard on a podcast last week.
Well, it's like the emperor's new clothes, right? The emperor says, I have new clothes and they're invisible. And everybody is going along with it, even though no one can see the clothes. And it takes a child, I think, right from the story to say, why is that guy buck naked? Like, it's the kids that will do that, that will say, they'll say the most obvious thing that no one else is saying.
Yeah.
And it comes up with their theological questions. They're just saying like, wait, how does this work? Or why would that be true? Or,
You know, here's a normal week for me is I'll lecture, right? I'll have a full week of teaching and lecturing. I've got 200 students in my classes, and I will do a full week of lecturing. And I'm pontificating. I'm brilliant. People are seeing things they've never seen before.
Right.
And I'll come home on Friday night and the family will get in the tub and my son will just say, he'll say or ask a question that I have no answer for.
Right.
I don't even know how to start. I don't even know where to begin. He asked a question 2 weeks ago, and it was about prayer, and I don't know what to say.
Yeah,
I mean, it's the most exposing thing in the world. I mean, I'm chewing and chewing and chewing on this question, this sacred question, that frankly no adult would dare to ask.
Yeah, when we have these Advent groups that my family's been doing lately, you know, their families, kind of like a house church gathering together, we've kind of struggled the question of, for discussion time, do we keep everybody together? Mm. Or do we separate out the kids so that they have some game time, some targeted discussion with things that are relevant for youth? We've done kind of a mixture of both. But it sounds like what you're encouraging is we need to have some time in church and maybe even the academy where we are open to having kind of to and fro dialogue with children, you know, where we obviously we're used to teaching them, but where we can hear from them. Here's what I think we face in the church is a battle for control. Churches want to control what happens, not in a bad way, but let's keep the service moving. Let's make sure things don't get awkward and weird. But the reality is kids are awkward and weird, and we want to hear them sing. We don't want to hear them talk.
Ah.
So how have you seen it modeled in a Christian environment where you can invite children into the conversation?
Well, I distinctly remember, this is actually one of my first church memories. You know, I was not raised in a Christian home, but I remember my friend that I grew up with, my friend Blair, who was, his family went to this Presbyterian church down the road near our home. And I would go with him maybe once a term or so after a sleepover. We'd go to church on Sunday morning. And the memories of that experience, I probably was 6 or 7 or 8 years old, maybe a little bit older than that, 9, 10. But I have a couple of memories that really stand out to me. Number one, I remember as a kid, the communion that was left over, they always let us eat. So we would go into the kitchen, and that was like the cool, it was like we would gorge ourselves on this bread that was left over and the grape juice. I mean, it was so awesome. I also remember the way the church smelled.
Hmm.
There was like a church smell. I don't know how to describe it. It's like a mixture of frankincense and bleach. I don't really know how to describe it. I just remember the smell.
Okay.
Yeah, weird. The third thing I remember is that there was a moment in the service when the pastor would invite the children to come up and be on the stage and would do the children sermon time. And then the children would leave and go into the kids' room. And, you know, in most evangelical spaces, we don't do any children sermon stuff. We send the children into another room and then we talk to the adults.
Mm-hmm.
And I gotta say, I think we probably would be more transformed by listening to a children's sermon than often just hearing the adults. Because if it applies to a child, it applies to everybody.
Right.
But if it applies to an adult, it doesn't necessarily apply to everybody. It's almost like children offer the base level humanity. And if it applies to a child, it applies to everybody. I don't know. It would be so cool to see there be a 10-minute time for children in our services and to see how that affects the adults, to have to listen in. I love what you just said, by the way. We want children to sing, but we don't want them to speak.
Yeah.
Because they are disruptive.
Yeah, and they're unwieldy. I mean, who knows what they're going to say, right? And maybe you don't want to embarrass them, but... you know, I've been in churches where they do have a little like 5 to 10 minute children's message, and everybody loves it because it shows that we're engaging a younger generation, that we care about them, that they're part of the church. I want to recommend a book real quick. This is by a scholar named Sharon Ketchum called Reciprocal Church, Becoming a Community Where Faith Flourishes Beyond High School. And the whole point of the book is adults learning from children, children learning from adults in a reciprocal context. I think that's fitting with what you're saying. I want to tell you a story from when I was in college. I went to a Nazarene church, a very small Nazarene church, maybe had 50 people, maybe 50, 60 people in it, salt of the earth kind of folks. And one pastor ran the show. He'd drive around, pick up people for the church. He'd pick up college students. I mean, he was wonderful. And they had this tradition, which I really love, where they had this brown bag, just a regular brown paper bag. And they would pass it around from family to family with young kids. And a kid could put any one item in the bag and crumple it up. And then during the service, the kid would come up and hand it to the pastor, and the pastor would make a sermon out of what's in the bag.
Oh, wow.
Like a little short, little 5 minute. So he'd take it out. If it was chapstick, he'd take it out. He'd say, "What is this?" The kid would say, "It's chapstick." He's like, "What's it for?" This would give him some time to think. And then he'd say, "What does chapstick do?" "Oh, it covers you, protects you." "Well, doesn't Jesus do that?" It was the best thing. Like, doesn't Jesus protect your soul? You know, I mean, it could be any, it could be toothpick. You know, it's like, "Oh, what does a toothpick do?" "Get all the gunk out." "Well, doesn't Jesus do that?" It was just so fun because your goal in life was to stump, right? It's like, "What is this?" "It's a bear trap." "Well, we're trying to trap Satan." Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's one thing to teach children, which is good. I think what you're saying is a whole nother level of a spirituality of childlikeness.
Yeah.
And even a mutuality, that's probably where it becomes the hardest.
Yeah.
And you know what? This is important for parents. It's not just the church. I get into these modes where I just basically tell my kids what to do, punish them, tell them to do their homework, tell them to brush their teeth. And I don't sit there and say, I don't sit there and think, AJ, what can I learn from my kids? Now, obviously, they're becoming teenagers, so I can't do their math. I don't understand the level of chemistry and stuff they're doing. So I am starting to realize, gosh, they are growing up. But what you're talking about is really an openness, a spiritual openness to God speaking to us through children. Isn't that what you're talking about?
It's a Christmas story. I mean, if we're unwilling to do it, if we're unwilling to learn from a child, why in the world would we receive Jesus? I mean, there's that great picture in Luke's gospel when Mary and Joseph lose Jesus for 3 days and they go to the temple. And what is Jesus doing? He's chatting with the temple, you know, the religious leaders. And I'm curious, like, were they teaching Jesus or was Jesus the Messiah teaching them?
He was able to hang with them. I think it was this question and answer discussion thing, but I mean, it's gutsy, right? It's like a 12-year-old going into an adult game of pickup basketball, yes, and schooling them, hitting the threes.
Yeah. Yeah. When we were in Sweden this 2 summers ago, we got to go to Sweden. I was speaking at a big Pentecostal pastor ministry thing out there, and we got to meet a guy who worked for Lego, which is in Sweden. It's nice. A huge, obviously, Sweden. They've come up with many incredible things such as IKEA and Lego. Well, Legos. I didn't know this. This was the historiography of Lego. I hadn't done any work on this. There was actually a period of time after the 70s and 80s when Legos actually tanked. They were not doing well.
Yeah.
And it was sort of, people got into video games that sort of lost Legos. Legos were not like what they are now. I mean, you look now, adults are into Legos. I mean, it's like a whole movement right now. They have figured out how to tap into the adult movement. Anyways, this guy who worked for Lego was telling us that their revival in the late 1990s and early 2000s came after their marketing team decided to actually start listening to children and what they wanted with Legos.
Mm.
And the simple act of listening to children changed the company forever. It's a multi-billion dollar company now. And it became a reality when they started listening to kids. And again, I'm not saying that kids are always right. There's this awesome book by C.S. Lewis. I think it's called Letters to Children. And what he talks about when you write kids' books, do you write books because kids want the message, or do you write what kids need to hear? Right. I'm not saying that you just Lewis landed on the idea that you don't write for what kids want, that you write for what kids need. And I think that's absolutely true. I'm not saying that we just do whatever a kid wants. If we did, the world would be run by Legos. I mean, that's not the world that we can live in. But when we do listen to children, the profound spiritual benefits in our walk with Jesus are almost incalculable. I mean, they ask questions, they push us, they bring joy back to thinking about God. Now, you, Nijay, you're a New Testament guy. Just for a moment, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the ancient world in which Jesus found himself, It was a tough gig for kids, wasn't it?
Yeah, if you think about, like, kids should be seen and not heard, in the Roman world, it was kids should be not seen and not heard. For example, the Greek word pais can mean child or can mean slave. Why would you have a word that can mean child or slave? If you yell pais and a child and a slave both come, like, how is this a differentiating? It's not. That's because kids weren't really significant in the Roman world until they came of age. Paul even hints at this. He hints at this in Galatians, where he says, while children are before adulthood, they are only a master in theory. They haven't become that yet. And so therefore they're like a slave. Hmm. You know, he basically says if they never grew up, they might as well have been a slave. And so the default setting for children was you're nobody until you're an adult. Doesn't that sound familiar? We have problems with this as well? Where, you know, think about the abuse situation we have in the United States, sexual abuse of children. Think about the gun violence situation we have that is especially targeted towards schools. Like, why schools? Like, why schools? Like, what? It's horrible at shopping malls. It's horrible out there in a rock concert. But why schools? Because of the vulnerability of children, right? Yeah. Yeah. And even more so in the Roman world. So you mentioned that text where Jesus says, "Let the children come to me." Jesus was sending a signal that we need to stop underestimating people, right? Just like people underestimate Jesus, we need to stop underestimating children, right? We can't have tiers of importance and say, oh, you know, the adults are important, but the children are unimportant. And I think that's also the way we look at time, right? My work time is important, but my time with children is unimportant. It's not the way that Jesus looked at it. If I'm going to hit home, AJ, I'm going to hit it pretty hard here. The way we pay our children and youth pastors reflect our value of children.
Yes.
Right? If we say, oh, a children's pastor deserves half the salary, or a quarter of the salary of one of the other pastors. Or training. If we say, well, a preaching pastor needs, you know, 7 years of higher ed, but children's pastor, oh, well, not that important. Hmm. What are we saying about the value of children, right?
Too close to home. I mean, I can think of moments when I did pastor where that was reflected in our budget, and I need to repent and own that. That is a tendency. It's a point of temptation for any leader. Is that why do we value adults more? Because the adults are the ones that
they pay,
provide the money. Yeah. And they're the ones that get the tax deductible sheets at the end of the year. And so we value those that give the money over the least of these. And it's a, yes, I can, I'm complicit, I wish that you didn't bring that up. Now I feel sad, because the reality is, I mean, we all have, and it's not just pastors, but we all have a sort of ingrained, the spirit that was in the disciples that tried to usher the kids out of the room. It's in all of us.
What's funny is the disciples were like teenagers. So they're not like these grisly, like 45-year-olds like me, they're teenagers. Yeah. So they're even flexing a little bit on these kids. If these kids are like 7 and 8, I mean, these disciples are what, 16, 17, 15 years old. And
that sounds like more of a bully situation than anything, like a teenager bullying a kid. Like, yeah, they're bullying.
Scram, kid.
Yeah. Yeah.
I, you know, for me, what this hits home for, AJ, is how we look at time. Because when we're together in church, time is precious. The clock is ticking. Literally, when I look back at what the pastors are looking back at on the back of the sanctuary, is they're looking at a clock. It's counting down. This is how much time we have in the service. And we're always making decisions about what is worthy of being in the service. What is worthy of our religious time? What is worthy of our collective time, right? And actually, I don't think this is just a children's issue. This is a church issue where we feel like my time is only worth hearing a paid professional that is a great speaker, or a paid professional that is a great musician. And so what we're saying about children, I don't want to get us off track, it's equally true of seniors, right? I think the degree to which we don't want to hear from a 11-year-old is the same degree to which we don't want to hear an 80-year-old. Mm-hmm. But let me give a positive note. My son was baptized a few years ago, so he would have been 10 or 11. And it was an evening service at our church. There were multiple baptisms, and each person, young and old, got to share their testimony for about 5 to 10 minutes. And they prepare you. You have several weeks. They train you. They kind of give you some prompts on how to write it out. You write it out. They proofread it. They make sure it's like makes sense, all of that. And they read it. And it was so beautiful in this baptismal service to have people in their 50s being baptized, people in their 30s, and an 11-year-old, right? Or a 12-year-old getting baptized. And I can't tell you the rapturous applause when my son gave his testimony. It was authentic. It was rehearsed. It can be both. But he felt like $1 billion.
Yeah.
He felt like $1 billion when they cheered. Ooh, I'm getting a little misty-eyed just thinking about it. Because rarely do adults listen to young people, right?
Yeah.
Rarely. And they were listening. They hung. And I can't tell you how many people came up to me afterwards and they're like, that was the best speech, you know? So here's the bottom line. It can be done. We could do it. We could do it. It takes work. We got to train. Some churches have like Youth Sunday, which is not great, but it's something, right? It's not great to have one service a month, a year, but it's something where you prep the kids to preach and teach and testify and lead worship. I think that's a start. It can get us on the right track, but first it has to be in our heart that we feel like we're open to hearing.
Yeah, even on an individual level, Nijay, just the simple decision to say, you know, whether we're a parent or we're a grandparent or we're even a teenager, whatever, that we intentionally build in as part of our discipleship plan, some relationship with a kiddo.
Yeah.
Just a child that asks us good questions and reminds us to play and not be so darn committed to what time it is and enter into the moment. I mean, that's what kids teach us is screw the clock and just play.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
and so just even one of those, just one child just has a powerful impact on our journey with Jesus.
One of our mutual friends, Preston Sprinkle, I know he brings his daughter on, maybe other kids on the show every now and again. I get a kick out of that.
Yes.
I think that's really cool. And maybe that's a challenge that we need to do that at least once, but get our kids on to just talk to us, answer some questions, ask some questions. This is really important, AJ. When you brought this idea, at first I thought, okay, where are we going to go with this? But you got me pumped that this is a real necessity in the church. I do think of the next generation, and if we don't engage them and we don't partner with them with the church, we're going to be in big trouble,
yeah,
right? You know, in an era we have 80-year-old candidates for president,
yeah,
right. We've definitely proven that we have not done a good job of nurturing the next generation, and probably the same in the church as well. So thank you for bringing this up, AJ. It's a great subject and a lot of food for thought. I hope listeners will take this seriously, maybe even take some action steps. I want to end on one of my favorite anecdotes from a young person, young Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I think he was a 13-year-old and he had a kind of agnostic sort of family. This was in Germany. And he walks in to the breakfast room in the morning one day and he says, you know, he says to his parents and his siblings, I want to be a pastor. And he's 13, right? I want to be a pastor. And you know, his parents who don't have a lot of love for the church say, hey, you know, the church is corrupt, don't you? And Bonhoeffer thinks for a second and says, well, then gosh darn it, I'm going to reform it. And he did. And so that's just a word to say, here's to our kids and to the opportunities we have to be challenged by them.
Yeah.
Thanks, AJ. So good to talk to you.
Yeah, good conversation. Thanks, Nijay.